This is the town and these are the people. This is the town where the people all stay. This is the town and these are the people. That's the way they wanted it. That's the way it's going to stay.
Greetings, everybody. This is Vince. This is The Point, the show. My first show of the fall semester, 2009. You were just listening to Harry Nilsson from the album The Point. I hope that to be the theme song or something similar to the theme song because it's the name of the album is The Point and that's the name of the show. So first of all, my name is Vince. You already heard, but I had a show here last semester and semester before that, and then my first show was previous summer ago, so this is not a new thing for me, even though I sound a little shaky. This is my first time on the air in a little bit, so I hope you all bear with me. Also, if you want to contact the show, you can even go on air, live on the air. You can call 607-777-2137. And we can put you on the air, or we can hear your complaints or concerns or your input as to what you think I should be talking about. If you're on campus, you can call 72137 or just 777-2137 if you're in the Binghamton area. You can also listen live at whrwfm.org. There's a listen live link at the top of the page that you can click and follow the instructions. You have to have a media player on your computer to be able to listen to the feed. And you can also, if you're so inclined, you can instant message me on the AOL Instant Messenger program at the screen name is WHRW Music. All one word, WHRW Music. So you can instant message me and I can take your ideas or anything like that. I can't guarantee that I will respond immediately to you as I'm in the middle of a show, but if you're in the middle of class or you can't get to a computer that has speakers or a radio, then you can feel free to instant message. Hopefully this show will be concentrated around natural gas and the natural gas drilling. This is a really big topic in this area, a very widely publicized topic so far, and hopefully it will become more widely publicized as this show continues and other people and other groups gather more information and more people become involved in this whole movement. So we will be talking about many aspects of the show. Oh, I forgot to mention I have a engineer assistant here, Nastasha Noel. She is going to be my phone answerer and news lookup expert. So you may not hear her voice for some time or at all, but she is incredibly important to the whole operation. So that's why I say we. If I say we sometimes, it's for the both of us. Local news. We have a couple articles. I got them from the BU Pipe Dream, the BU Pipe Dream newspaper. First article is, the city of Binghamton plans to demolish or deconstruct 20 buildings and give them away or sell them for $1 to be used as green spaces, community gardens, and new green homes. The city also plans on taxing the owners of these vacant lots or abandoned buildings for at least $10,000. This is an attempt to cap a growing deficit in the budget that the city is facing. Mayor Matt Ryan is considered by many and deems himself a progressive mayor, and this is the first in many ideas and attempts to cover a budget without excessive taxing and without taxing groups that are normally taxed, lower income and people who can't afford to be taxed more. So this sounded like a really great program that he's doing. It also comes on the heels of $105,000 trail that he is increasing from the Sherry Lindsay Park and the north side of Binghamton all the way up to the Atsenango Park, which is farther north, and make it a 4.5-mile trail. So I'm really excited about the project and about the projects that he's starting, and it sounds like he is really trying to find a way to bridge this deficit while also keeping the money that people earn in their pockets. So I hope it works out, and I hope that these attempts and maneuvers are going to work. The second news article from the BU Pipe Dream is a little bit more concerning. The county executive, Barb Fiala, is coming up with ways to meet budget needs without raising taxes. However, a main idea is drilling on county property for natural gas. The main problem with this is that the county has already allotted $5 million in its budget for drilling. And in some cases, in some reports, has already spent that money that where the drilling has not even begun yet. Already, obvious problems with spending money that the county doesn't have. And so this comes on the heels as well as the county and Barb Fiala hiring a law firm with taxpayer money to go to Albany to lobby the governor and the DEC to hurry up and its findings with the gas drilling so that the drilling can commence in Broome County as well as other counties. This seems like tricky and shifty politics, not only on the fact of spending money that the county doesn't have, but of counting on money that's coming from a process and an industry that is seen as destructive and toxic and is highly controversial. So there will be more on that and later in the show when we talk about natural gas drilling and government involvement in that. That came in the State of the County address by Barb Fiala, where she was praising the drilling and counting. The two sites would be the Broome County Airport and the landfill area that's near there where they're going to be drilling, which are both county land. In larger scale, in national and international news, there's been a gas pipeline in Rio Grande City, Texas. A population of around 12,000 blew up and caused a huge fireball which had been burning for around 36 hours. The old age of the pipeline is considered the cause of the explosion, and a part has been dredged up and sent to Houston for testing. With workers at South African Miner Goldfields, Tarkwa Gold Mine in Ghana have begun a go-slow action in a pay dispute and have threatened a full strike, company and union officials said on Tuesday. Tarkwa, the biggest gold mine in Ghana, produced almost 660,000 ounces of the precious metal in 2008, according to Chamber of Mines data. Ghana is the continent's number two gold producer after South Africa. The workers here are on go-slow action. This means they are working but not actually working. For example, if they have to go and pick up something, it will take them double or three times the usual amount to get that job done, said Anthony Aubin, corporate affairs director for Goldfields Ghanaian Operations. Aubin declined to quantify how much production had been lost as a result of the go slow, which began early on Tuesday. Talks about pay between the company and workers' representatives were ongoing, Aubin said. Those negotiations were not proving fruitful, said Prince Ankara, General Secretary of the General Mine Workers Union, which represents Ghanaian miners. This, I'm afraid, can degenerate into a full strike action, Ankara said. Tarkwa employs 1,805 permanent workers and almost 3,000 contractors, according to the Goldfields website. And that was an article from Reuters. And now from another website, these next few articles coming from a site called mostlywater.org. And so the first one is State Department finances right-wing Venezuelan youth to slander Chavez in the U.S. In the midst of an international campaign launched against President Chavez, carried out by the extreme right from Colombia and supported by Washington, the U.S. State Department has organized and financed the trip of 8 young Venezuelan politicians to the USA in order to denounce the Venezuelan government and to strengthen the links between young U.S. Republicans and the Venezuelan right. The 8 young Venezuelan men and women have been selected by the U.S. State Department as part of the program Democracy for Young Political Leaders. It is a project of the Interchange Program International Visitor Leaders Venezuela, which is being used by the Washington administration to recruit and train political actors who would later on promote the North American agenda in Venezuela. The trip to the USA, during which the young Venezuelans were accompanied by the U.S. State Department representatives, lasted 3 weeks. From August 17th to September 4th, they visited different U.S. cities, meeting with political groups and institutions apart from meetings with the communications media and Washington agencies. The U.S. State Department's International Visitor Leadership Program was created by Washington as part of a propaganda initiative aimed at recruiting spokespersons and international political actors willing to promote the international imperial agenda. During the program, the participants attended training workshops conducted by political representatives of the USA on representative democracy, freedom of the press, a la USA, and reinforcement of political parties and leadership, amongst other topics. This comes at a time when the international right, together with Washington, is carrying out a smear campaign against the Venezuelan government with the Bolivarian Revolution, which emphasis on the figure of President Chavez. Next article, throwing bullets at failed policies. This also has to do with the South America. It was a winter day in Argentine city of Bariloche when 12 South American presidents gathered there on August 28th. It was so cold that Hugo Chavez wore a red scarf and even where I was put on a sweater. The presidents arrived at the Union of South American Nations meeting to discuss a U.S. plan to establish 7 new military bases in Colombia. Though officials in Colombia and the U.S. say the bases would be aimed at combating terrorism and the drug trade, U.S. military and Air Force documents point to other objectives. Earlier this year, when Ecuadorian President Rafael Correa decided to not renew the U.S. lease on the military base in Manta, Ecuador, the U.S. set its sights on Colombia, a longtime U.S. ally and one of its biggest recipients of U.S. military aid in the world. Under the agreement the U.S. eventually developed with Colombia, the U.S. would have access to 7 military bases for 10 years, stationing up to 1,400 U.S. personnel and private contractors. One U.S. military document cited by the AP explains that the Palenquero base in Colombia, which the U.S. plans to transform with a $46 million upgrade, would be a stopping-off point for the U.S. military and Air Force so that nearly half the continent can be covered by a C-17 military transport without refueling. Uruguayan analyst Raul Zabechi cites the U.S. Air Force's April 2009 report entitled Global En Route Strategy, which refers to the ability to utilize these installations above all for air transport, making it possible to have control from a distance and act as a dissuasive force, leaving direct intervention only for exceptionally critical situations. The cooperation of local governments is a key aspect of this plan. This ongoing cooperation is much more important than direct military presence. A current military technology allows troops to concentrate in any given area within a matter of hours. Next article, U.S. Census Bureau confirms rising poverty, falling incomes, and growing numbers of uninsured. In early September, the U.S. Census Bureau released its new report titled Income, Poverty, and Health Insurance Coverage in the United States 2008, showing disturbing data that portends much worse ahead under a president and Congress doing nothing to address it. In 2008, poverty reached 13.2% of the population, its highest level in 11 years. the result of millions losing jobs during the first year of the gravest economic crisis since the 1930s. For blacks, the figure was nearly double at 24.7, and 31% of all Americans were impoverished for at least 2 months between 2004 and 2007, years of economic expansion. At year-end 2008, even by the Bureau's conservative measures, 39.8 million people were impoverished, the highest level since 1960, and 17.1 million lived in extreme poverty at below one-half the official threshold. In addition, for the first time since the 1930s, median household income failed to increase over a 10-year period from 1999 to 2008. The Census Bureau states that it presents annual estimates of median household income and poverty by state and other smaller geographic units based on data collected in the American Community Survey, covering population areas of 20,000 or more. The Bureau's Small Area Income and Poverty Estimates program also produces yearly figures for states and all counties, as well as population and poverty estimates for school districts. It uses data from a variety of sources, including surveys, administrative records, intercensal population estimates, and personal income data published by the Bureau of Economic Analysis. The official poverty thresholds were developed more than 40 years ago and have been criticized for not taking into account rising, or since the 1970s, inflation-adjusted falling standards of living, expenses such as child care that are necessary to hold a job, variations in medical costs across population groups, and geographic differences in the cost of living. Australian Navy abused refugees after boat explosion. In early September, a federal parliamentarians debated whether to end the repulsive government policy of charging refugees for the cost of their own imprisonment in detention centers. Damning revelations emerged that Australian Navy personnel prevented badly burnt refugees from climbing onto rescue boats. On April 16th, a boat known as CF-36 carrying 47 Afghan asylum seekers exploded near Ashmore Reef in the Timor Sea. The Navy had intercepted the vessel and were escorting the refugees to the Australian Refugee Detention Center on Christmas Island. A September 7th article in The Australian reported, "In the minutes after the blast, male Navy personnel forced survivors trying to cling to the bow and the sides of a rescue boat back into the water." Afghan community leader Hassan Ghulam had conducted interviews with some of the surviving asylum seekers. Hassan told The Australian, "They were pushed by hand and forced away by legs, not kicking in the face or anything, but they were being pushed and sailors were shouting, 'Get off, go away.' Many of the asylum seekers were poor swimmers or were unable to swim. Another Navy rescue boat had to move in to save the refugees from drowning. Five asylum seekers died in the tragedy. The Australian reported that some of the asylum seekers told Hassan that though that they thought the deaths occurred from drowning after they were pushed away by Navy personnel, others said they thought the five asylum seekers had died in the explosion. The Defense Department has so far refused to comment on the new allegations, but has not denied the claims. We have another news update from the briefing room. Last night in Lebanon, New York, a township northwest of Binghamton, a two-hour meeting about a proposed 16-inch steel gas pipeline broke out into yelling as citizens upset by gas well fires and inadequate responses by the gas drilling company, Nornu. According to the sources, people were yelling when the town supervisor, Jim Goldstein, asked at the end of the meeting for a show of hands from the attending Lebanese as to whether the town should issue the road bore permits thought tonight as requested by Nornu, no one wasn't so inclined. Nothing like a couple of gas well fires and obviously inadequate contaminant runoff mitigations to focus people's minds. That's about all I have for the international, national, and local news section. You are listening to WHRW 90.5 FM Binghamton. This is The Point. I'm Vince, the host. Binghamton Yellow Bike. Your help is needed to help grow a free bike program that provides the community as a whole working bikes to use and share. We are looking for bike parts, old bikes, tools, supplies. Please contact BinghamtonYellowBike at gmail.com for more info. This is a bike program that I helped to create, and it's less of a communal type bike program and more of a bike program that focuses on redistributing bikes and leaving them out for public use and helping to grow an understanding between people of a community of sharing and of unselfishness regarding bicycles, and then hopefully regarding other things as well. The bikes are put out there for anyone to use, and when you're done using it, you're encouraged to leave the bike in another public place for someone else to use. There's also contact information on the bicycles that if they're broken, or if you want to help, or if you find a bicycle that needs repairs, or that you think would be a good yellow bike, that you can give that email address, send that email address a letter, and let them know about the bike that you found or any problems that you're having. Right now, or last time I did this, the bikes were actually painted orange. Maybe this next time I'll be painting them yellow, or generally we paint them a very bright, obtuse color that helps to detract people from wanting to just take them and use them on their own, and more likely to share them with other people. The bike program, I know the yellow bike personally has started in Portland, but it's gone in the Netherlands, in France, Spain, in Barcelona, Washington, D.C., Helsinki, Copenhagen, Sweden's in Stockholm, London, so in Canada, and I know in a bunch of different cities and in college campuses all over the country, there's been different yellow bike programs of different degrees. I know sometimes that they've used different methods of collecting and distributing bikes using painted bike racks as a way to corral all the bikes so that people can go to one location to borrow a bike, or perhaps using a common lock system where a key is given to someone to unlock a certain bike, and that they give that key back or give that key to another person when they're done using the bike. So hopefully all those things will be thought of and perhaps a more permanent solution for the yellow bike program. But if you have any questions or want any more information, binghamtonyellowbike@gmail.com. All one word, binghamtonyellowbike@gmail.com. Also, Food Not Bombs, every Sunday and this Sunday, 1 p.m., serving free hot vegan food. If you wish to volunteer, donate, or ask questions, please contact binghamtonfoodnotbombs@gmail.com. I've also been a part of this program as well for close to a year now. They serve at Columbus Park in downtown Binghamton, which is right near the current BC Junction on the corners of Carroll and Holly Street. They start cooking at around 10:45 in the morning on Sundays and are ready to share food at 1 p.m. They're more than open for anyone helping them and to lend a hand, or if you have a dish of your own that's vegan, no meat or animal products included, then please feel free to stop by and share food, or if you just want to go there and eat and have a good conversation and a good time, then please also stop by at 1 p.m. The weekly Binghamton Peace and Justice Vigil at the corner of State and Henry Streets, ongoing since the late 1990s. I know many people that go there, and I've been there on a couple times on occasion, and really great people, and they would really appreciate if you came and brought your own signs for the Peace and Justice Vigil, or if you don't have any signs, they have already pre-made signs that you can go there and hold and tell people to honk for peace and justice. And it's really, really, really great, and also highly recommend going there. And just if you're not interested in holding signs, it's a good opportunity to go there and meet some people in the community that are actively trying to encourage other people to get involved in peace and justice. All right, folks, I just got a phone call from an old friend of mine, and he wanted to talk about a few words about the economic and poverty issues I discussed before, and also a few words about the other things he had been listening about and things he's doing. So let's see if I can get him on the air. So you're on the air now. So if you want to talk about what you were hearing on the air relating to the news or just whatever.
First, I'd like to say I fully support the bike program that you're involved with. It's a very good concept. It's very useful. I'm trying to expand the one up at my school because it's restricted. It's only to be used for campus Yellow Bike program, but for campuses. But I want to expand it so we can go off campus and go to town. So,
yeah,
I'm trying to get that started. But I'd just like to say that's a very good program.
Great.
And but first, you were talking earlier about you know, how poverty and you know, basically due to the economy, is all going up, basically. And you're also talking about, well, Matt Ryan is doing a lot of good things, but locally, crime has gone up a lot because of unemployment and poverty areas. And Matt Ryan has cut a lot of spending towards the police department. I read about this about a month ago, so I don't know if it's still relevant, but is that really the right thing to do? I know Matt Ryan is doing a really good, because you're talking about his green program, you know, buying the buildings for a dollar and then charging tax. I was just seeing what you think about him cutting out the areas. Is it necessary to cut in other places for these programs?
That's a good question. I think a lot of this has to do with looking at a city or looking at a county as a system and how each of those parts relates to the whole system and how other parts influence, how one part of a system influences another part of a system, and such that you have to look at why is there crime and not as much as look and is accepting crime as a constant, but looking at what causes crime. Is crime is caused by things. It's not just something that's part of a city or part of a county. And so by looking at what causes crime, you can then go to the issue of why are people committing crimes, as opposed to should we instead just try to have more police officers? Because if you anywhere you look where there's many police officers or little police officers, there's still a crime. And so perhaps another way of looking at things is just to approach it as, well, what are the reasons that people are causing crimes, and how can we change our mode of thinking to look at that as terms of how can we help them to avoid committing those crimes, whether it's giving them a sense of pride in their own home or a sense of pride in the work that they do, or not giving them a reason to commit a crime if they have enough money and they don't need to pay rent or they're, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, yeah.
But, yeah, thanks for calling in.
Oh, yeah, thanks.
All right.
Take care.
All right, that was a really great phone call. I kind of dominated the back end of his question there. That was a really good question, and that was also something that was brought up by another friend of mine about tax cuts in the city of Binghamton as well, where the mayor had talked about increasing taxes, but also had talked about at the same time cutting many government positions, and that seemed to be contradictory to many people. I am all for him cutting certain government positions if those positions aren't serving the people. If, for example, police are a big one that aren't necessarily, the police don't necessarily always serve the people in the ways they need to be served best. For example, if you find ways to decrease what the motivations for people committing crimes, then you're already being able to not hire police officers if people are committing less crimes because they have less reasons to commit crimes and they have less motivation to commit crimes. So it's a very tricky subject, and I don't think it's something that can be approached as far as attacking one subject from one point and saying, should we do this to fix this problem, instead of looking at something as a circle or as a pie or as a system, where you look at, if we do this, what's going to be the relation to all the other pieces of the puzzle, and what's going to be the relation to all the other system functions, and can we manipulate another system function in order to get the results that we want in a different but related system. So, and that kind of what I was saying about crime and police, it's a very common theme of increasing police officers to reduce crime. Police are seen as crime stoppers, but it's not as common to look at people having better jobs and more pride in their community and more respect for each other and more respect for their neighborhoods and their elected officials. And with that increased respect, there's less of a lesser chance to commit crimes of aggression, commit crimes of desperation, So that's just my personal take on it. And I think there's also other alternatives too. There's also different systems that can be affected by it, that can be manipulated to get the same kind of effect. So that was a good question. I appreciate calling in, and I hope I didn't talk over you too much, but I appreciate you calling in very much. I have to take another break. All right, folks, I'm back. I just had a caller in there and a little bit of a discussion. Glad he called and whatnot. Also, for the callers that were just calling in, if there were someone that was just trying to call in, feel free to call in now. I can put you on the air, or I can hear what you're trying to say. Right now, I'm 607-777-2137 to call in. Send me an instant message, WHRW Music, on AOL Instant Messenger. You can also listen live, whrwfm.org. Go to the Listen Live link at the top of the page and follow the instructions, and you can be listening all over the globe. I'm going to do a little discussion on natural gas, kind of a primer on what's happened in the past, as well as what's going on presently, and possibly what you should hope to expect in the future, or what you can prepare yourself for. If many of you don't know, gas drilling has been happening in New York State for over 200 years. Most of the gas drilling, if all of the gas drilling that's been happening, has been from vertical wells. What, if you are familiar with gas drilling, that has been the traditional way of drilling for gas, which is going straight down into the earth and looking for the gas pocket in a single well. And around 1950, Halliburton, a company you may be familiar with, former Vice President Dick Cheney was CEO of the company recently. Halliburton came up with a process called hydrofracking. These were not immediately used for gas drilling. The combination of both of them were not immediately used for gas drilling, but are now being combined to make a single gas well many times more efficient than a vertical gas well. Being able to drill a vertical hole straight down into the earth and then go at 90-degree angles from this well into other areas of the ground surrounding that area, up to many miles of horizontal wells that can be drilled. This is a very new and very advanced and involved process of drilling that is about to take place in this area. We'll get into that later. I want to discuss what exactly hydrofracking and hydrofracturing and horizontal drilling mean in relation to the natural gas, and then we can get into what's going on currently. Horizontal drilling, like I said, involves going down a vertical well and then breaking off on 90-degree angles and going in a horizontal well. Sometimes each individual horizontal well can be many miles. This allows the well to be much more efficient, like I said. In conjunction with that, hydrofracturing is using water, sand, and chemicals injected into the ground in order to break up small pockets of gas and release the gas from whatever is holding it, whether it's shale or other rock formations or other types of earth that's holding the gas. Depending on the type of hydrofracturing that is done, there could be up to many millions of gallons of water used per well, per every time they do a hydrofracturing, every time they do the action of hydrofracturing, there could be many, up to 5 million gallons of water used. The companies claim that only 0.5% of the water used is chemicals, but if one were to do the math, it would equate to many thousands of gallons, tens of thousands of gallons of chemicals per well, per every action of fracturing. So while 0.5% does not seem like much, there's tens of thousands of gallons of chemicals, unknown chemicals, and known cancer-causing chemicals that are injected into these wells. So with these two technologies, scientists and then further companies have been able to think they're able to exploit the rock formation underneath the Broome County area and the greater New York and Northeast area called the Marcellus Shale, something you may have heard of in the news or read about in newspapers. Marcellus Shale is one of the world's largest single rock formations in the world regarding natural gas. It goes all the way as far north as the Finger Lakes region in New York State and as far south as Virginia, and extends east to west from middle of Ohio all the way down into the Catskill area of New York. Companies have projected up to 10 years of natural gas use for the country from this shale formation. These numbers keep fluctuating. It started at a few years and now has been projected at many more years as technology increases and as they're actually starting to dig the wells, companies are getting more of an understanding of how much gas there is actually there. So companies predict many billions, if not trillions of dollars of profit and of many, many years of gas dependence on natural gas dependence on this Marcellus Shale formation. Where Broome County sits is about 4,000, the shale formation is about 4,000 feet underneath the ground, which is about mid-range. The shale range anywhere from 1,000 feet all the way down to 9,000 feet. So currently, what is happening in New York relating to horizontal drilling is the main point of contention right now, what I had talked about with Barbara Fiella hiring the law firm to lobby New York State. There is a supplemental generic environmental impact statement, otherwise known as the SGEIS, which is also something that may have been in newspapers and news reports. The impact statement is a statement that is done by the State Department of Environmental Conservation, the DEC. And what that statement says, what that statement is allows is the it's a set of guidelines that the industry, all industries, have to abide by. And its main importance here is the fact that it hasn't been updated since 1992. This is the first time that it's been updated since then. And so the main relation with the industry here is the natural gas drilling and how specific regulations regarding natural gas drilling are going to be either toughened or weakened by this impact statement. The impact, and so right now many groups in this area and the companies themselves are kind of in a holding pattern as to what they are going to be able to do and their next action following that. Companies are waiting to make sure that they can drill here and make the most amount of profits if the impact statement were weakened like they hope it is. And many groups are hoping that the impact statement does not allow drilling or allows heavy regulation of drilling, which will discourage many companies and corporations from blatantly drilling in areas without any precaution. It was set to come out last March of 2009 and has since been pushed back now to this month of September 2009, with the possibility of it getting pushed back further, although many people seem to think that it is going to come out this September. That could be just speculation or wishful thinking or politics, but everyone is anticipating this report. After this report comes out is when the drilling will start, if it is going to start. My thoughts aside from this whole issue, this impact statement is kind of a breakpoint as to the whole movement on both sides. So a lot of what's to come and a lot of the action and involvement in communities and corporations is going to be amplified much more once this impact statement comes out and the trucks and the drilling rigs are in your area. With that, it's also important to take a look at this drilling from a expanded view and look at how this came to pass. Like I had said before, the drilling from Halliburton, this technology had been introduced, or this hydrofracturing and horizontal drilling had been introduced in the 1950s, and it has already been used. It's being used currently in Pennsylvania, which is very close to us, just south of the border here in Binghamton and the New York State border, places like Dimmock, Pennsylvania, and other areas in Susquehanna County, and all other places that fall within the Marcellus Shale are currently being drilled with horizontal and hydrofracturing drilling going on there. The Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection does not have any guidelines whatsoever regarding hydrofracturing or horizontal drilling, and that is also what was important about this current meeting being held in the Forest City High School has to do with how the DEP is going to protect people's drinking water. In many areas throughout the country where horizontal drilling has been used, there have been cases of houses exploding, water so contaminated with gas that it catches fire, brownish, dirty water that is completely undrinkable, tremors with magnitudes of small earthquakes, cattle and deer dying from drinking water with hydrofracturing material, and destruction of natural waterways, streams, ponds, swamps, rivers. Any place that has water has seen incredible damage done to it, not only from companies taking water. Like I said, in many cases, they use up to 5 million gallons per well. But also, after the water comes up, only 60% of the water actually comes back up to the surface. 40% of the water and chemical solution remains underground. So the water that they're taking from your swamp or your stream, which they have every right to, according to New York state law, the companies have access to all waterways that can be accessed from a public road. So if your stream or your swamp or your little pond is on the side of a road, or if the favorite pond of yours in a park, a state park, or any government land within the state can also have water taken from it. This water, only 60% of it comes back up to the surface. 60% of that mixed with chemicals comes to the surface, and the other 40% remains underground where it leaches into aquifers. Aquifers are the main source of water for many, many, many millions of people throughout this area and throughout the country in general. Aquifers tend to stretch for many dozens of miles, if not hundreds of miles, and people as far away as New York City can be affected by aquifers that are many hundreds of miles away. Just as in Binghamton, people in Binghamton can be affected by aquifers that are just as equally as far away or equally as connected. The Clinton Street ballpark aquifer is one of the main aquifers in this area, and that is considered already at risk by many of the industries that are in this area in general, and is also considered to be at increased risk due to this hydrofracturing. An aquifer is an underground water system of sorts where fresh, clean water runs and sits underground. Much of this water is tapped for use by people in their homes. The Clinton Street aquifer runs all the way from the Binghamton area in Broome County through Owego and Waverly into Tioga and Chemung counties. This is a huge deal for our area. It's a huge deal for any area in New York State, in any area in the country where there's hydrofracturing, as water can leach into these aquifers, and like anyone will tell you that's in the science of hydrology or in geology, that you cannot clean up an aquifer. Once it's tainted with poison, there's no way of drilling underground to put the water through a filter. It's not like being able to run your water through the filter that you have in your home. This is water that's underground, very far underground, that cannot just be cleaned up like you would skim off a swimming pool. So it's important. These are some of the issues. Water especially is a very important issue, as there are going to be a lot of people that aren't necessarily going to have drilling rigs on their yards, and there aren't going to be people that are going to receive money from gas drilling, people who live in the middle of cities, people who just aren't in the shale, that are still going to have to drink water every day. You take showers, you cook food, you just drink water in general, and your water is at grave risk of being contaminated. It was just released this past week or 2 weeks ago by the EPA that in Wyoming, Pavilion, Wyoming, that I think 3 of the 10 wells that they had tested had proved to be contaminated by the hydrofracturing materials. Now, whether this was the fault of the companies or whether it was just bad luck, I don't really know who else could be at fault here, but needless to say is that these water supplies are being contaminated by the chemicals that are used in the drilling process. And so that's why for many groups this is a very important debate, and not just for many groups, but I think for everyone that's going to be anywhere within 500 miles, maybe 1,000 miles of drilling, this could be a problem. We've even found here that the Susquehanna River, which runs right through Broome County and Binghamton, which also flows straight into the Chesapeake Bay in Washington, D.C., the Susquehanna River is also one of the main sources of water for Binghamton. If the Susquehanna River gets contaminated with hydrofracturing materials, that directly correlates to drinking water and water sources all the way down south, right in straight into Washington, D.C. This is a huge, huge issue it's not that it's not important here, but it's to put in perspective that anyone, no matter where they are, within a very, very, very large radius of this drilling area or any drilling area, is putting themselves and putting their neighbors and putting other people that they're never going to meet in jeopardy. And it's important that this gets more publicity. And so with that, also, I wanted to talk a little bit about the government side of things. I had discussed Barb Fiella and her hiring the law firm, and that kind of goes into another topic I wanted to talk about too. Water is a very important issue, but I also think that it's important that people realize that their own government and their government officials that they elect, or if you didn't elect them, the ones that represent you either way, that these people are acting in the interest of companies in many cases, and that they are not being held accountable for their actions. And I think that this is not being brought up enough in the media, and this is not known to many people. In 2005, the energy bill was passed by George Bush, the 2005 energy, I think it was called the 2005 energy bill. In it, there was something that is commonly known as the Halliburton loophole, which puts all natural gas industries exempt of the Safe Drinking Water Act that was in place in the 1970s. Basically, this says that everything relating to the natural gas industry and all the chemicals, these companies do not have to report any of their findings, any of their problems to the EPA or to any government body, which seems to be a very large conflict of interest. As I mentioned before, Dick Cheney, the vice president at the time, was the CEO of Halliburton, which does hold the patent on the majority of fracturing materials and was the inventor of the process in the first place. On a large scale, you can see this, but also as going company to company, like many groups and many researchers have done, asking them what are the chemicals in your processes, and companies have maintained so far that all these chemicals are non-toxic. In one case, Theo Colburn, a researcher with the Endocrine Disruptors Exchange, was told that there was guar gum, soap, and water, I believe. I think it was something like guar gum, soap, and something completely non-toxic. And although that was mildly outrageous, and I think it was an attempt to brush her off, it was also evident of the overall negligence that gas companies are legally allowed to use in regards to their chemicals. And this is a federal program. This is a federal exemption to a program that regulates your drinking water. If no one else can, if at the highest level of government, the federal government, there is exemptions to your drinking water, then every other government body below it cannot enact any laws that are any more stringent than the federal government's. That's another federal law that applies to other branches of government. But the federal government in most cases sets a precedent and a standard for laws in other states, and it's a huge precedent to exempt this company from drinking water. So I think that's important to discuss about that. It's 12:51 now. I have 9 minutes. I just saw someone else poke their head in. So I think we're getting towards the end of the show here, and I think it's about time to do an edible plant. This is something I've done for all my shows. I've tried to include plants in the area that are edible, medicinal, and not just plants like a tomato plant, but plants that you see in your walk through the park, or you see in your walk to school, or in your drive home, or maybe in your front yard, that you perhaps don't consider to be useful, or you just look at them and you don't see much of anything. This is also, talking about this natural gas issue, this is also a start to an alternative way of thinking about fuel and about energy and about how you can take care of yourself in this world. I think a main question to ask me and to ask what I was saying is, you know, there does seem to be problems with natural gas, but what can you offer me as a solution? And I think a start of looking at the world around you and looking at plants and looking at them less of just an object and more of just a vital part of life in general and a part of existence is a good way to promote an alternative to energies that's not just a band-aid or a sidestep, such as solar panels. So being able to feed yourself without having to even rely on any sort of energy is a really huge step. And so the plant is a favorite of ours, and I think should be a favorite of everyone's. It's probably not a favorite of many households listening, but it's the dandelion, Taraxacum officinale. There's this, usually use all the information from Plants for a Future, www.pfaf.org, and Edible, Medicinal, and Useful Plants for a Healthier World. Hazards: this plant has been mentioned in various books on poisonous plants, but any possible toxins will be of very low concentration and toxicity. There are reports that some people have suffered dermatitis as a result of touching this plant. This is probably caused by the latex in the leaves and the stems. The dandelion itself is easily identifiable, not only by your own personal experience, but it seems it's one of the number one targets of these chemical weed commercials, and so the short plant with the little yellow head. Let's get into what we can do with it. It's a fairly magical plant. The leaves, raw or cooked, when used in salads, they are rather bitter, tough, less so in the winter. Tender young leaves are considerably less bitter than older leaves. Leaves are often blanched by excluding light from the growing plant before use. This will make them less bitter, but they will also contain less vitamins and minerals. A very nutritious food, 100 grams of the raw leaves contains about 2.7 grams protein, 9.2 grams carbohydrate, and 187 milligrams of calcium, 66 milligrams phosphorus, 3.1 milligrams iron, 76 milligrams sodium, and 397 milligrams potassium. Vitamin A, vitamin B1, vitamin B2, vitamin C. The root can be eaten raw or cooked, bitter. It's like a turnip-like flavor. The flowers, raw or cooked, that the yellow heads, a rather bitter flavor. The unopened flower buds can be used in fritters. And they can also be preserved in vinegar and used like capers. Both the leaves and the roots are used to flavor herbal beers and soft drinks such as dandelion and burdock. The roots of two-year-old plants are harvested in the autumn, dried and roasted to make a very good coffee substitute. It's not a caffeine substitute, but it's a coffee flavor substitute. I feel like I should qualify that. It is caffeine-free. A pleasant tea is made from the flowers. They're also used to make wine. I have a friend that's making dandelion wine. All green parts should be removed when making wine to prevent a bitter flavor. The leaves and the roots can also be used to make tea. That was edible uses. Medicinal uses, we have 4 minutes left. I'll try to not skip through this, but I want to at least talk about it. The dandelion is a commonly used herbal remedy. It is especially effective and valuable as a diuretic because it contains high levels of potassium salts and therefore can replace the potassium that is lost from the body when diuretics are used. A diuretic is something that makes you urinate and that's used to flush the body of certain toxins. Why it's more effective as a diuretic is what they're saying is in many diuretics, your body also loses potassium, whereas dandelions, it contains high levels of potassium, so you're not losing that nutrient when you're using it. All parts of the plant, but especially the root, are slightly aperient. Whilst the dried root has a weaker action, the roots can be used fresh or dried and should be harvested in the autumn when 2 years old. The leaves are harvested in the spring when the plant is in flower. It can be dried for later use. A tea made from the leaves is a laxative. We'll leave you on that note. I'm going to play a little closing song here and let the next DJ come in and set up, and I can kind of close down all my stuff. A personal favorite of mine, so I hope you all enjoy it. I hope you enjoyed the first show. It was a little bit hectic for me and a little bit kind of intimidating to be back on the air again, and I feel like I needed a little more time to rehearse what I was going to say, but I think it worked out well. So here's Frank Zappa, Uncle Remus.